The Verdict was a powerful best-selling courtroom thriller written by Boston lawyer Barry Reid. It was later adapted by David Mamet into a successful film that won 5 Academy Award nominations, including one for Paul Newman in the lead role. Now it has inspired a major stage production that will visit the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin from May 30th until June the 3rd. It stars Jason Mraz in the play, where he plays a washed-up alcoholic lawyer, Frank Galvin, who has one last chance at redemption, a medical malpractice case that has left a young mother, Deborah Ann Doherty, in a coma.
You know, someone once said, there is a time for living and there is a time for dying. In the early hours of November the 22nd, 1976, the world that Deborah Ann Doherty knew died with her. It was not her time to die.
Frank, it's time to go.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client can't be here, so I am here for her.
Jason Mraz there as Frank Galvin, who is starring in The Verdict, which is coming to the Gaiety Theatre in May, at the end of May. And Jason Mraz joins us now. Jason, can you tell us, recall the plot of The Verdict and the role of Frank Galvin, which is a very juicy role, a very complex and flawed character?
Yeah, it's a story of redemption, really. I mean, Frank is a middle-aged lawyer my age. He's 55. He's kind of on the skids. He's on the lowest rung of the legal ladder in Boston, even though when he started out as a lawyer in that city, he was second in his year. So he has this brilliance as a lawyer, as a bedrock to his character, but somehow he's lost his way. He's a serious alcoholic. He thinks he's a functioning alcoholic, but he's functioning a lot less well than he thinks he is. He's estranged from his wife and his children, separated. He's been philandering for most of his life. He's kind of ringing up funeral homes to kind of tout for business. He's pretty much on the bottom rung of the ladder. And then this case comes before him, and he goes to see the victim of this terrible, terrible mistake that happens in this hospital. And he decides that this isn't enough to settle for this. He's going to fight this case, but he's going to take on, at the same time, the whole legal establishment of Boston, the church who run much of the city, including the hospitals, and the whole establishment of that hierarchy, which he is a part of. He's an Irish Catholic, second generation. His father came over on the boat, like so many. And, you know, he's fighting his own kind, really. But it everyone thinks he can't win it. But for him, it's something that he has to do. And it kind of wakes him up. And I think it's a wonderful story of someone who's deeply flawed, but is able to do somehow something right. You know, because none of us are perfect.
Tell us about the Boston that he is working in and taking on this case in. I mean, people from Ireland will know how Irish Boston is, but it had a huge political and religious power whack, didn't it?
It did, it did. And I think, you know, one of the things we touch on in our version as well, I think the film touches on it too to a certain extent, but is how white it was as a city. I mean, obviously there was a black population there, but it wasn't the same kind of, from what I understand in my research and in our research, it wasn't the same kind of cohesive community that you would have, for example, in Chicago or in New York in the black community. And it was very much dominated by the Irish community, whereas you get the impression in cities like New York, it's a bit more mixed between different communities. Whereas in Boston, it was very much the Irish Catholic kind of influence was all pervasive in a way. And they were very powerful and perhaps still are. But certainly at that time in 1980, the hospitals were under their wing. The legal outfit that Frank is fighting is very much a high Catholic affair, and they were in every single aspect of the government, because most of the population were either first or second generation Irish. Irish was spoken quite frequently in bars and restaurants.
Oh, you know. Really? Yeah. And Frank, then, as you say, he's at the last rung, bottom rung of the ladder. He's, you know, on the skids. And yet, what yeah. is it, you know, he goes and visits this young woman who's in a vegetative state. She's been so badly yeah. treated. But what motivates him to be able to, you know, scoop himself up off the ground and, you know, become the functioning lawyer that he knows he can be, but you would think he's past the point of rescue?
Yes. Well, I think that's it. That's exactly it. I think what happens is that Mo, who's his mentor, basically, Frank came from a very poor family. His father was a doctor and he fought in the Second World War. And when he came off the boat in 1945, as a lot of those guys were, they were offered opportunities because, you know, everyone was celebrating. It was a time of renewal. And all those guys that came back from the Second World War were offered university places. They were offered apprenticeships. And Frank was offered an apprenticeship with Mo Katz, who's his mentor, who's a Jewish lawyer in Boston. And he put him through law school. And he came out of that law school second in his whole year, which when you're against all those Ivy League guys, that's quite something. So he always had that skill and that energy as a bedrock. When this case comes before him, I think also he's not pure completely. His arrogance kicks in. Mm-hmm. His sense of self-belief kicks in. He thinks, I'm good enough to do this. And he actually risks a lot. He risks the settlement figure that is given to him initially by the Catholic Church that run the hospital. He risks losing that by fighting this case. So he takes a terrible risk on his own ego, in a way.
Yes.
On his own belief in himself. So it's not without ego and it's not without selfish kind of desire what he does. But then I don't think that matters if ultimately what you achieve is to the good. And I think he's transformed by it. I don't know quite how much. That's outside of our remit in the play. But he's transformed by it. And certainly what happens to him during the run of it is transformative. And I think that he intends to redeem himself by what he decides to do, you know.
So it sounds like a wonderful role to take on, but there's all those elements. You're the drunk, you're also the person who has to kind of face up to their failures and then at the same time kind of push through and be, you know, because it ends up as a courtroom drama where you have to be impressive in the courtroom.
Indeed it does. And that's the wonderful thing about this adaptation that I fell in love with when I was approached about it. It's really deftly done, the way that it knits together this story of Boston, of the politics, of Frank, of his life, of a burgeoning love affair between him and another key character, his friendships and his love and sort of doting sort of father-son relationship that he has with Mo Katz because he lost his father when he was a boy. So all of those relationships are really well drawn. But then in the second half, we're in court and the courtroom itself is so dramatic. It's adversarial, it's competitive, it's theatrical, it's performative. And so when you put a courtroom within a play on stage, you kind of double that dramatic power. And we all really enjoy that. And we all really enjoy the run up to the courtroom and then getting on the pitch and really going for it as hard as we can. Because I think that once he reaches that stage, he's not going to not rise to the occasion. Do you know what I mean? He's going to absolutely make sure that he nails that case as well as he can. And that's exciting to watch. It's exciting to play and it's exciting to be a part of, you know.
So I mentioned the David Mamet film version of the Sidney Lumet directed. And Paul Newman, of course, plays the character of Frank. So but you're saying not that they're different characters, but that the story is told in a different way. Mamet went a different way to it than the original writer, Barry Reed.
He did. And I think he did things. You know, David Mamet is an amazing, genius, gifted writer. And he did things. his way. And he made it a very mammoth script, and it's a wonderful script, and it's a wonderful film. It's very distilled. There's less dialogue in it than there is in our play, for example, because, you know, you can do that in a film, and you can have reaction shots, and you can have musical sequences and be inside someone's head in a way in a film that in theatre you can do, but you have to be clever about the way that you do it. You have to do it in a slightly different way. So our adaptation is theatrical. It's for the theatre. But also I would say that our adaptation is much more the story of Boston as a city, as an Irish Catholic city, in much more than the film was, because the film didn't really want to get too bogged down in that and make it more universal, I think. Whereas our version is very much rooted in what this city was and what it was like in that time. And so I think that's really interesting as well, exploring, you know, what someone like Frank would speak like from South Boston, someone who was a working, but saw himself as a bit of a working class hero, so probably would wear his South Boston accent quite proudly, you know.
And how is your South Boston accent?
Well, I hope it's okay. I've worked hard on it, but yeah, it's an interesting accent. It's quite hard because it's. It's very similar to New York, but because it's very close to New York, but it has these flattened A sounds that you have to incorporate in. They have a saying in Boston, which is park the car. And if you can say park the car, then you kind of get those flattened A sounds that I think you'll recognize from films like The Departed and Mystic River, films like that that are set in Boston.
And Jason, people will know you from television shows like Agatha Raisin, Finding Alice, and then even the third season of Happy Valley. You are known, I suppose, mainly as a TV actor. Do you see it as very different stage acting to film or TV acting?
Well, the method of delivery is different. So you've got someone in the gods in the back of a theatre that you've got to reach and you've got to convince. And when you're on a set, a camera might be 2 foot away from you. So that method of delivery changes. You know, you don't have to hit the back wall. You don't have to perform and be a slightly larger spectacle because you can just think it. And that's the beauty of working with a camera. You can just think the truth. And the camera will pick it up. The camera will also pick it up if you're not, which is the dangerous and challenging thing about it. And that's the same in the theatre. You know, you have to be a compelling character that is telling the truth, you know, is being truthful about what the story is within his imagination. So if you're not able to convey that, then it doesn't work, and people feel that, you know, people turn off. So that's always the challenge in both those instances. I mean, I find that if I've done a lot of filming, then I want to be on stage, and vice versa, you know. So I hadn't done a play for 5 years, but then up in October I did a play in London, Terry Johnson's new play, The Sex Party, and that kind of tail-ended with the rehearsals for this. So I've been doing two plays back-to-back, but I've been really enjoying it. It's very invigorating, and it's a different kind of energy and discipline that you use, different muscles that you use. It's kind of demanding physically and vocally in a different way, you know.
Another unusual thing about your background is that it was not drama college you went to, but art college.
That's right, yeah.
And is
Yeah, I studied art, fine art, yeah.
And obviously art college, usually there's a foundation year that gives you an idea of all different kinds of art forms to see what you're most interested in. But you wouldn't think that I guess there is performance art. Was it something like that? Was it the college itself inspired you to go into performance, or was that just another need that needed to be satisfied?
I kind of, to be honest with you, to be absolutely honest, I'd kind of dropped out a bit and in my A-levels, and I was traveling. I went traveling with some mates, and I was meant to go around Europe, and I ended up in Paris, and I ended up staying in Paris for about 2.5 months. And I was kind of living in tents, living in squats, and I was kind of doing a lot of drawing, doing a lot of street portraits and stuff like that. And then I got this letter from a phone call from my mum. And she said, oh, you've got a letter from this college you got in. So I kind of came back and I went to this college that I'd applied to. And it had foundations in kind of performance and music and English, as well as your core subject, which for me was painting, fine art. So it seemed the ideal thing. I'd done kind of Saturday drama workshops and stuff, and I'd always enjoyed it. By the time I came out of art school, I was doing fringe plays at Edinburgh, and I was kind of in company in Brighton that was going up and down to different festivals. So I was kind of on the circuit, on the fringe circuit, but I was still painting, and it was very much could have gone either way for quite a while until I got a big break on Casualty when I was about 24, and that took me away, and that started a kind of different arc of my career, you know.
And that's why we have you in the Gaiety at the end of May. Jason Morrells will play Frank Galvin in The Verdict at the Gaiety Theatre from the 30th of May until June the 3rd. And you can find out more details on gaietytheatre.ie. Jason, thank you for joining us tonight. The film Cairo Conspiracy is an intense political thriller written and directed by Tariq Saleh, a filmmaker who grew up in Sweden. In the film, we meet Adam, a bright young man from a fishing village who gets the chance of a lifetime when he is offered a place at the prestigious Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the leading international centre in Sunni Islam. But when the elderly Grand Imam dies, Adam is dragged into the power struggle to replace the holy man. The government, who are nervous of political unrest, want to ensure that the new Grand Imam is one whose teachings are aligned with the government. But a radical group within the college has its own candidate. Adam is recruited against his will to spy for the government, answering to the state security officer, Colonel Ibrahim. I'm delighted that Tariq Saleh joins me now on the line from Stockholm. Tariq, if we could start with a bit of biography. I said you were from Sweden, but your father's family is Egyptian, and his parents came from a village not unlike the fishing village that Adam came from. So does that biography influence the Cairo conspiracy?
Oh, yes. It absolutely does. And, you know, my grandparents actually came from villages around the Nile Delta, and they were farmers, but they became teachers. They were, my grandmother and grandfather were the first in their villages to get an education. So they then became teachers when they were married, and they were sent to the exact same fishing village as in the film, Matareya.
Now, I think, is it true that the Cairo conspiracy began as an idea after you read Umberto Eco's book, The Name of the Rose, that kind of idea of conspiracy within religious institutions?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. It's one of my favorite books, but I reread it as a grown man. You know, I read it as a teenager, and at that time it was sort of a Harry Potter to me because I didn't understand the intricacy and sort of how he's sort of investigating the religion through a crime. And when I read it as a grown-up, I was totally blown away by what courage he had to go in and place a genre inside of a monastery. And I was like, could I do that? And I was like, absolutely not. That's out of the question, you know. That's how it began.
And the world, the film is mostly set in the Al-Azhar University. That's an ancient university. I mean, founded in 972. What can you tell us about its origins and how powerful it is in Egypt?
Oh, yeah. So it has a fascinating history because it was built by the Fatimids, which was a Shia sect. This group they wanted to create a sort of a learning center for Islam. But when Salah ad-Din took Egypt, when he invaded Egypt, he turned the institution into a Sunni University. It was the first thing he did. He wanted to change Egypt into a Sunni country, and he understood that he needed to make the learning center a Sunni center. In Sunni Islam, there is a problem with authority because, you know, no man is closer to God than anyone else, you know? So we don't have a pope, we don't have that kind of institution. So it was only natural that the most powerful place would be a learning center, and knowledge would be at the center of power in Sunni Islam. And that's why Al-Azhar, through the centuries, became this place where leaders were turning, and every Muslim, basically every Sunni Muslim, if you want to have an answer to a religious question, you will turn to Al-Azhar.
The Grand Imam then is the head of that institution, but he also has much more power in relation to the government and relation to the people, as you say, in Egypt. Could you, yes. Does he compare to the Pope in terms of if you're of the Sunni religion?
He is the closest thing you can get to the Pope. And here is why it is so, where you could actually compare it is because in Islam, it influences every aspect of life. And you've probably heard the expression fatwa. A fatwa is a religious recommendation. And the problem in Sunni Islam is that any imam can declare a fatwa. You know, because it doesn't have this structure, this authority structure. But there is no fatwa that is stronger than the fatwa of Sheikh Al-Azhar. And that is because of the weight of the institution and because people actually believe that they have the knowledge to declare religious recommendations. So if you're a leader in Egypt or in the Arab world for that matter, but especially in Egypt, and you want to change a law, you know, people in villages and people, they will be like, yeah, you have your little law. I follow the laws of God. So they need to have religious recommendations coming with their law, basically. So that's how this institution becomes so powerful.
So into this comes innocent but very clever Adam, this young boy from a fishing village. So, and he is snapped up by this character called Colonel Ibrahim. So can you bring us into the role Colonel Ibrahim has? A fascinating character, a dangerous character.
My inspiration, of course, you know, I am also a Jean Le Carré fanatic. You would call me a Jean Le Carré fundamentalist. You know, I have read his books twice and I love his book. And of course, it's a blink or a homage to Smiley. And Smiley is an interesting character because I don't think that Smiley believed in the gospel that the states that the circus is preaching, you know, it's not that, but he believes in doing a job well done. He believes in carrying out his mission into perfection. And I don't remember in which book it is, but there is in one book, someone accuses him and says, "You're a fanatic without a religious belief." That's the most dangerous kind, you know. And I think that Colonel Ibrahim is very much a man like that. He believes that he should do his job into perfection, but he doesn't believe in his mission, which makes him a very conflicted character in many ways.
Yes, and his mission, which he then puts this on Adam, because Adam is in such a weak position, is to find out what the more radical Muslims within the university are up to.
Oh, yeah. And also to make sure that the least likely candidate, but that the government loves because they have control over him, gets elected, which is, of course, a complicated and very razor sharp edge to walk on, because they cannot officially be involved in this, because officially the Grand Imam, or Sheikh Al-Azhar as he's called, is elected by a council. It's called the Council of the Supreme Council of Scholars, which is 31 imams. And, you know, it's a place that should have integrity. And state security doesn't have a seat at the table, which they are frustrated over. So they decide to manipulate the election.
Yes, and manipulate they do, and they use Adam to get their information so that they can manipulate the election. What are the parallels with what is happening in Egypt at the moment? Egypt is now run by President Sisi. And we know that Sisi led a coalition that overthrew Mohamed Morsi. Obviously, there is those tensions between the radical and the, we might think moderate, but moderate who enforces their moderate beliefs through an iron fist.
Yes. You know, what is fascinating and interesting there is that, of course, when I wrote the script, for me, you know, it takes a long time to make a movie. There wasn't a real conflict between el-Sisi and Sheikh el-Azhar, but you could say that in reality, the situation is the opposite, because el-Sisi, the president, he's the new guy on the job, right?
Yes.
So he basically needs to put al-Azhar in line, right? And the way he does that is that he's trying to muscle them. If they don't do what he says, he removes certain privileges that al-Azhar has. But the real Sheikh al-Azhar, who has been there on the job, he's very, very intelligent, very sophisticated. So he's not really having it. So they've had a pretty open conflict where a power struggle in front of everyone. And this is sort of, for Egyptians, this is so extreme because no one defies el-Sisi. He is sort of a pharaoh, you know. Mm-hmm. You do not defy him. And so Sheikh al-Azhar Tayyip has openly sort of challenged him. So I was sort of freaked out because my film is fiction. I wanted it to be fiction. It was sort of a play with the idea, what if this happened? But then it became reality. And as Sisi, there is this moment, it was a couple of years ago, where Sheikh al-Azhar and Sisi was on television together. And all of a sudden, Sheikh al-Azhar starts to tell this story about a king who had no knowledge but wanted to rule. And everyone understood that this story he's telling is about Sisi. And, you know, this became a sort of a, you know, people all over the Muslim world started to share this. And, you know, I was like, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. Do not steal my plot.
Yeah, you're ruining my film.
You're making my film into a documentary. You're changing genre.
You filmed Cairo Conspiracy in Turkey. Is that because you're persona non grata in Egypt?
Yes, and I knew that when I was writing the script, because I had been thrown out of Egypt when I was going to shoot the film I did before this, the Nile Hilton incident. And when that film came out, I mean, they made it very clear. I mean, they said on television, if Tariq puts his foot in Egypt, we're going to arrest him. So I knew that I couldn't go and shoot it there. And I had this great opportunity that Sisi and Erdogan was in a sort of a, they had a fallout, you know, exactly around the time when I shot Cairo Conspiracy, which was very good for me. So I took the chance and went to Turkey to shoot it.
Well, look, at John Le Carré and Umberto Eco would be very proud of the results. Thank you so much, Tariq.
Thank you.
The Cairo Conspiracy is in selected cinemas from the 14th of April. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. I'm joined now by our album reviewers, Zara Hederman and Pat Carty. And we'll talk about the albums in a moment, but sad news reaching us that the guitarist with the script, Mark Sheehan, has died at the age of 46. Pat, tragic news for his family, friends and the band.
It is, absolutely. It comes as a shock. He was a very young man. He was 46. And I think maybe some of us, some people maybe in this country don't realise how big the Script are, you know, what a massive band they are. Their music has been featured in loads of TV programmes like 90210 and EastEnders, which, you know, must have reached a huge audience. And Danny O'Donoghue, wasn't he the coach on The Voice UK? And they've won 3 Meteor Irish Music Awards and 2 World Music Awards, 2 Brit nominations, and they've sold over 20 million albums worldwide, which is pretty impressive.
Now, I don't think he had been on their last tour. Is that right, Zara?
Yeah, no, he hadn't. So they were on the US leg of their Greatest Hits tour, and he actually took a bit of time away to be with his friends and family. And Danny O'Donoghue, the singer, had said that he had taken the bit of time off, and he had noted that, you know, you get refreshed and then you come back with a new zest of life. And I believe this would be the best thing that could have happened for us. And he did say that, you know, that him and Glenn, the other member of the Script, got on with the American leg. And he was saying very sadly how when they do get back in a room together, how it will be magic. And I think that's a testament to their friendship, because as successful as they are, as Pat was outlining there, they have been friends for such a long time. Like, they formed the band in 2001. So, of course, thoughts with Danny and Glenn, and of course, Mark's family as well at this time.
Absolutely.
Very sad. Well,
thank you for that tribute to Mark Sheehan, who's passed away today. And this is the Script with The Man Who Can't Be Moved. The Man Who Can't Be Moved, the Script there, with the sad news that guitarist Mark Sheehan has died, or yesterday Guravam. Time now for the album reviews, and first up, legendary LA rockers Metallica, formed all the way back in 1981. Today they celebrate 42 years in existence with album number 11 in their career, entitled 72 Seasons. Next up, Daughter, the indie folk trio formed in London in 2010. The band is fronted by singer Elna Tornra, and Stereo Mind Games is their fourth album. And finally, Blonde Shell, stage name of the indie rock singer, songwriter and guitarist Sabrina Tittlebaum. Based in Los Angeles, her first single under the name Blondshell arrived in June of last year, and her debut album, also entitled Blondshell, is out now. Pat Carty and Zara Hederman, as I said, have been listening to our 3 albums tonight. And let's start this Friday evening review slot with some rock and roll. Metallica, the current album is called 72 Seasons, and this is the opening track, the title track, in fact, 72 Seasons. That was Metallica with 72 Seasons, the title track and the opening track to their current album. They're 11 so far in their 4-decade career. As I say, Pat Carty and Zara Hederman are with me now. So 11 albums up, Pat. Is this classic Metallica? Is there anything but classic Metallica?
Well, I think it is classic Metallica in the sense that it's different from maybe the Metallica that the general public might be familiar with. It's more like the early days of Metallica, and I think it's deliberately so, and I think the last couple of albums have been like that. The one I was talking about there is the Black album that came out in the early 90s, and it ended up in 17 million homes in the US alone. So in a way, Metallica, no matter what myself and Zara say now, are beyond criticism. You can't go near them. This is like that title track we heard there. If we tried to listen to the whole thing, we'd be here till about 8:30, and that's just the first track alone. And the first track is fantastic. And if it was all like that, I wouldn't have any problem at all. That's like Motorhead finding a particularly lethal bag of speed and going in and trying to do a prog rock album. It just sounds fantastic to me.
And what is particularly fantastic about that track?
Well, you know, I don't like to use 4-letter words on the radio, but there's a prog element to it. It's like it's got movements. It starts off with this riff that's almost like a relative of Thin Lizzy's Hollywood or AC/DC having a bad day. And then, you know, it goes double time, then it switches back to 4/4, then there's a guitar solo, then Hetfield comes in roaring and shouting about staring into black light. If that's not classic Metallica, I don't know what it is.
Now, Zara, you were introduced to them, I think, through the documentary Some Kind of Monster, which I started watching today. And
it's
it
fabulous.
Is just fantastic. The
it's
characters
hilarious.
In Metallica are something else. And in fighting, and they don't care who's watching them fighting.
It's
and
phenomenal.
All this angst and people having to go home to look after their family, but afraid that they're going to leave the band because what the band will do when they've left.
And the therapist in there as well. Yeah, no, it's probably one of the best examples of reality TV I've ever seen in my life. And I think with that introduction, it made me think that Metallica were quite cartoonish in both their personalities and then their music. And it didn't really inspire me to go back through their catalogue after seeing that documentary. But I will have to say that with 72 seasons, even though it is 77 minutes long, I did actually quite enjoy quite a lot of this. I did think that, and to my surprise, I thought that James Hetfield as a vocalist sounded quite rejuvenated. Lars Ulrich on the drums, I thought, you know, he is playing at such breakneck speed. Like, it's exhausting listening to him. I do wonder now how much the studio helped them kind of enhance their sound and their style. And it was something that I constantly as well throughout listening to this, I really want to see them live just to see how these songs work in a live setting. Because one of my main criticisms with this album, it was the length. And I did find that, you know, a lot of these songs are either 7 minutes long, they're 8 minutes long. The last one is 11 minutes long.
Oh God.
And within that, you know, there's some great instrumental breaks in there and they can be invigorating. But I did think that those moments were better suited to a live setting rather than me at home listening to them.
A bit too long for you, all of the tracks?
Pat? Oh, absolutely. I think it's like if you fell down walking out in the street and your face landed in a puddle and someone came up behind you and grabbed the back of your head and kept repeatedly shoving you down into the puddle. What's that George Orwell quote about a boot down on someone's face? There's a bit of that going on.
Okay, it's like, but you might regret falling in the first place.
Well,
so why
true.
Would you
no,
be
no,
listening to Metallica?
Is, the thing is, now, I had a friend of mine say to me this week, there's a new Metallica album out on Friday. It should be a national holiday. So if this was one of my favourite bands and they released an album that was 75 minutes, sure, I'd be jumping up and down. Mm-hmm. So for the faithful, this is absolute manna from heaven and they're going to adore it.
Now, you had a problem with the length, but you weren't so thrilled with their lyrics. I mean, I suppose it's not a band you go to for deep insight.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. No, lyrically, this was like there was times where, and even though I'm saying that lyrically, this is not the most nuanced or strong representation of Hetfield's work. I do find that they are a band you listen to their arrangements more so. But at the same time, I was keenly listening to what he was saying because he has some very funny moments where, you know, on Darkness, what is it? Darkness is a Son. If Darkness had a Son, and he said, if Darkness had a Son, here I am, I bathe in holy water. Later on, he's talking about, you know, wearing a crown of barbed wire, it's destiny I wear, it splits the skin to the soul, this jagged wreath I wear. But at the same time, there are quite a few songs. And
sounds great.
I know, no, it's great. But then, you know, at the same time, I did feel kind of bad laughing to myself at Hetfield's lyricism because he is clearly a man who we all know through the documentary, and if you're a fan of Metallica, who has struggled quite a lot with addiction. He's very open about his road to recovery and he does try to write about that quite a lot in this. And there are moments where you can kind of almost feel that he has written them straight after maybe being with his therapist and how he articulates things. So you can't fault him for wanting to try and better himself. And he's not the most nuanced, but he does have those moments previously where he does give you a bit of a chuckle.
Yeah, unintentionally. And there's that voice that's strained all the time.
He gives it socks all right, as do the rest of them. I was just thinking while Zara was saying that, it does remind you of the old, you know, I suffered for my art and now it's your turn. another thing that Zara mentioned was Lars Ulrich. One of the problems I had with this is the drumming, you know, while it's of course perfectly in time, perfectly accurate, it doesn't really swing. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't really have that kind of thing. I thought
it should be in the documentary. That was the big fight all the time. They kept wanting him to do something creative.
Kirk Hammett, I mean, I think in places here he sounds fantastic. They're amazing musicians. He is an amazing singer. I mean, it is a great voice. It's a powerful voice. But I just think, I mean, even if you looked at the titles on this, Room of Mirrors, Too Far Gone, If Darkness Had a Son, Chasing Light, Crown of Barbed Wire, Screaming Suicide. You wouldn't have to be told it was a Metallica album, you know. You're not going to mistake this for Daniel at all. There's no chance of that.
Stars out of five from you, Pat.
I would give it 3 out of 5 because I do think there are at least two great songs on it. And you kind of have to admire their lack of compromise and the bravado and the way they just, we're Metallica, here you go. If you don't like it, get out of the way.
And you, Zara?
I have to say, this really converted me and I'm looking forward now to going back to say like Master of Puppets. So for me, it's a 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 and 3 out of 5 for Metallica's 72 seasons. Next up, an English trio who go by the name of Daughter with a singer from London, a Swiss guitarist and a French drummer. They've been together since 2010 and have now signed to the uber credible 4AD record label. So what else do we need to know about Daughter, Sarah?
Well, in the 13 years that they have been together, they've actually done quite a lot considering they took a 7-year, as the Elena Tonra said, a friendly break, where she had a solo career. They've scored a video game. They've had 2 albums. Julian Baker, who of course is one of the biggest songwriters at the moment, had expressed quite a fondness for their second album, Not to Disappear, which when you consider now it's been 7 years between the second album and this one's quite an aptly titled album. But here I thought that they came back together actually sounding quite rejuvenated. They prefaced this album by saying that this was their most optimistic album and that it actually thematically looked at connection and disconnection. And the disconnection here is how they are all now not in their London base. They're spread between Bristol, London and Portland. And I do think that those different cities have seeped in to kind of enhance and elevate their previous sound.
Okay, well, you say optimistic, but I'm going to play a track that may not be so optimistic. It's called Party. So that's Party from Stereo Mind Games by Daughter. And Pat Carty and Zara Hederman have been listening to it for me. So I was just listening to you earlier about what you thought about this. And I think you think two very different things about this Party track. What do you think about it, Pat?
What do you think
is happening?
Do you think the party is in inverted commas for irony? First of all, the sound of that, it, to me anyway, is that plodding indie bass line is like if you just pressed indie in GarageBand, you know, and you just, it's the kind of fallback setting of it. She's talking there about, you know, my friends are vanishing. It's the worst night of my life. Put up the volume so I can drown myself out on the Stereo Mind Game. I'm trying to keep my... This party sounds awful to me, okay? And it's soundtracked by this really boring music. So, you know, maybe you should just leave the party. This youth is wasted on the young guy. You know, and I say
do you
that
think,
to you,
Sarah?
To me.
I actually thought that with that, the chugging guitar, I thought that element to this album brought great variety because I think ambient and immersive were two words that were often pegged onto Daughter's music. And my reading of some of Tonra's lyrics throughout, as much as I felt that she was talking to me and describing this tired party, Pat, as you described, I actually kind of took this as maybe her, because this, again, this is 7 years between releases and in that a lot has happened. I kind of took some of the things she was saying, like, I'm trying to keep my cool, my friends are vanishing, I'm scared I lost my head. I almost felt that she was talking to herself and kind of talking herself through her experiences as much for her own kind of progression as an individual, more so than for us as a listener, which I think as a songwriter is why people ultimately would make music. So I found that kind of context and her voice as well, I really like. I thought that context worked actually quite well for me with this
album. Okay, and not too down for you.
No, I mean, you have to take the good
with
the
sad. Place anyway, Zara. Thanks very much. Yeah, okay.
So, Pat, a stars out of 5 for Daughter.
Well, I did like the opening track. After you get through the intro, there's a thing called Be On Your Way, which I thought was very good. Just to contrast with Zara again, and not deliberately, I found her breathless kind of voice a bit trying. I didn't think a lot of this went anywhere. You know, songs would start off and be promising and not really get where they were going. So I give it 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 from you and for you, Zara.
I really enjoyed this and I enjoyed the artistic development that they showed with this album. So it was a 4 for me.
4 and 2, quite a contrast. Now, Blonde Shell, is the first album and it comes from an American singer-songwriter, Sabrina Tettelbaum. Pat, tell us a little more about her. She has made records under other pseudonyms before.
She has. She began a recording career under the name Baum, I think is how you pronounce it, and several singles, including one called This Body, which was on a Target ad campaign. and another one that was quite well known, which I can't actually read out the name of here on air because there's a swear word in it. But halfway through recording her second EP, she was doing okay, you know, and halfway through recording her second EP, she said to her producer, listen, this isn't the direction I want to go in. And she completely changed. She played him an acoustic version of a song called Olympus, which is on this new record. And he, which that is Yves Rotman, said, yeah, let's do that. And then brought out this record. And, you know, having listened to Baum, this is completely different and miles ahead of it. This is quite a strong record.
Okay, let's listen to Veronica Mars. That's Veronica Mars from Blonde Shell by Blonde Shell. So, in contrast to Metallica, so many contrasts to Metallica, but in terms of length, like the album is only something like 32 minutes long. Mm. The tracks are quite short and sometimes they're almost getting going and then there's this kind of dramatic stop almost for effect.
Exactly, like we hear with Veronica Mars, like that kind of lift with the more rockier instrumentation goes on for maybe about 30 seconds and then we're straight into the next song, which takes on a completely different mood. And in some ways, I think that that actually works and it's quite effective. It leaves you wanting more. And I did find that the tonal variety in this was, it did kind of interest me and it kept me wanting to come back more so the second half of this album, where she gets a bit woozier with some of the production. But I do think as well that this was just a very strong debut in terms of just her personality. Like, she's very frank in the way that I sometimes thought of, say, like Fiona Apple or Amy Winehouse. And unfortunately with Amy Winehouse, in this regard, Blonde Shell also has written extensively about her addictions and getting sober, and she's extremely frank about that. And I think in a debut album, that's such a strong introduction, because I enjoyed my time with her, even though it was difficult hearing some of her experiences, but it was very worthwhile.
Yeah, Pat, I think you were very impressed by her own guitar playing and then with the all the arrangements, even though they may have been a bit short in places. Yeah, well,
absolutely. The guitar playing is great, the arrangements great, the songwriting is great, as Zara pointed. I don't mean to contrast deliberately with Zara. I preferred the first half of the record. I thought the singles are very, very strong. And I thought there was some humour in it as well. You know, there's a song there, Salad, where she's talking about putting poison in somebody's salad. You know, it wouldn't be so bad. It wouldn't hurt the world. Look what you did. You made a killer of this Jewish girl. It's really good. It's going to, I think it'd be really, really good live. Her voice takes off. The only problem is, that and something like the song we just heard there, Veronica Mars, it's really just getting going and it comes to this stop. It's a very good record.
So stars out of five for Blonde Shell.
I'll give it 4. I really like this.
4 out of 5 from you, Pat. And for you, Zara?
It's a 3 from me.
Okay. And that was Zara Hederman and Pat Carty listening to Metallica, Daughter and Blonde Shell.